Omar Barghouti.
Thank you. Good morning. Before I start, I wish to make two comments. I couldn't help but smile yesterday at the irony when security escorted two unruly hecklers out of this room. Back in the 70s, and even in the early 80s, it used to be the Palestinians and Arabs who would do such things, interrupt and so on, for lack of better options. Disruption, misinformation, character assassination, and all sorts of ad hominem attacks are the weapons of the intellectually poor, I think. Only those who lack rational argument and persuasive logic resort to bullying. Today, these tactics have become a trademark of the Zionist movement, it seems. My second comment is that the dialogue, the presentations, the creativity, and the critical minds that I've experienced in this conference so far have really inspired me. I'm always optimistic that justice and true peace will prevail one day. Now you've given me a better chance to believe that. Thank you. So I'll start with my presentation, Israeli Apartheid, Time for the South African Treatment. She was five when a dozen heavily armed soldiers stormed into her family's apartment in Ramallah in 2001, asking everyone to leave so the army could use the place for its purposes. Her parents decided not to give up their home. They shouted in three languages, made frenzied phone calls, and stood up right in front of the military commander, saying, "You shall never take our apartment while we're alive." In the midst of these tense moments, the little girl's knee starts shaking visibly. She thinks she's seriously sick. Her mother comforts her, saying, "We're all scared. You're just expressing it differently." "What should I do to make it stop shaking?" asks the terrified girl. After some hesitation, the mother says, "Well, just go stand in front of that soldier and stare right in his eyes." "Are you crazy?" shouts the girl. "Look at him. He looks like a monster. His weapon is bigger than me." After some reassurance, the girl drags her feet to where the commander was standing and looks him straight in the eyes. He looks at her with obvious discomfort, then finally moves his eyes away, and the girl screams in English, "Yes!" And her knee stops shaking. Some Palestinian girls were not so lucky. Just this last month, 9-year-old Aya Al-Astal was shot to death by Israeli soldiers who claimed she looked threatening. An army investigation concluded the soldiers acted in accordance with army regulations. In 2004, Iman Al-Hams, a 13-year-old refugee schoolgirl, was executed after being wounded by an Israeli platoon commander in Rafah. An Israeli court cleared the killer of any wrongdoing. Even before the current intifada, in 1996, an Israeli settler near Hebron fatally pistol-whipped an 11-year-old boy called Hilmi Shusha. An Israeli judge acquitted the murderer, saying the child, quote, "died on his own as a result of emotional pressure." The Supreme Court termed the killing light killing. After some pressure from the media and otherwise, the judge reconsidered and sentenced the killer to 6 months community service and a fine of a few $1,000s. The boy's father accused the court of issuing a license to kill. This systemic and entrenched Israeli perception of Palestinians as relative humans, who are therefore not entitled to equality or to fundamental human rights, is what makes Palestinians recognize Israel's system of colonialism, racial discrimination, and denial of basic human rights as a form of apartheid. In fact, Palestinians are far from alone in holding this view of Israel. The UN Human Rights Rapporteur stated in 2004 that, quote, "there's an apartheid regime in the occupied Palestinian territory, worse than the one that existed in South Africa." Leading South African intellectuals, politicians, and human rights advocates, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, subscribe to that same school of thought. Brave Jewish South African leaders, including the current government minister, Ronnie Kasrils, issued their famous Declaration of Conscience, which states, quote, "It becomes difficult, particularly from a South African perspective, not to draw parallels between the oppression experienced by Palestinians under the hand of Israel and the oppression experienced in South Africa under apartheid rule." Even in Israel, some politicians and intellectuals have drawn parallels between Israel and South Africa. Member of Knesset, Roman Bronfman, criticized what he termed, quote, an apartheid regime in the occupied territories, adding, the policy of apartheid has also infiltrated sovereign Israel and discriminates daily against Israeli Arabs and other minorities. The struggle against such a fascist viewpoint, Bronfman says, is the job of every humanist, end of quote. Former Israeli Education Minister Sholomit Aloni recently stated that Israel commits war crimes, utilizes terror, and, quote, is no different from racist South Africa. What could have stirred all this moral indignation, one may wonder. The following representative samples of life under Israel's military occupation may help answer this question. Perhaps nothing captures the immense injustice of the occupation as much as Israel's colonial war. Built mostly on occupied territory and condemned as illegal by the International Court of Justice at The Hague in 2004. Despite the war's grave repercussions on Palestinian livelihood, education, health, environment, and political rights, a near total consensus exists among Israeli Jews in its support. The former Israeli Environment Minister, Yodit Naot, however, protested a specific aspect of the wall, saying, the separation fence severs the continuity of open areas and is harmful to the landscape, the flora and fauna, the ecological corridors, and the drainage of the creeks. The protective system will irreversibly affect the land resource and create enclaves of communities, of animals that is, that are cut off from their surroundings, end of quote. Even after irises were moved and passages for small animals were created in the wall, the spokesperson for the Israel Nature and National Parks Protection Authority still complained, quote, the animals don't know that there is now a border. They're used to a certain living space. And what we're concerned about is that their genetic diversity will be affected because different population groups will not be able to mate and reproduce. Isolating the populations on two sides of a fence definitely creates a genetic problem, end of quote. While so attuned to the welfare of wildflowers and foxes, Israel treated Palestinian children as dispensable creatures. Professionally trained sharpshooters fatally targeted them in minor stone-throwing incidences. And when there was no stone-throwing incident to hide behind, Israeli soldiers had to provoke one. The veteran American journalist Chris Hedges exposed how Israeli troops in Gaza had methodically provoked Palestinian children playing in the dunes in order to shoot them. He concluded his report saying, quote, children have been shot in other conflicts I have covered, but I have never before watched soldiers entice children like mice into a trap and murder them for sport, end of quote. As outrageous as they are, Israeli violations of human rights in the occupied territory are not the only form of oppression practiced against the Palestinians. Two other crucial dimensions of Israeli injustice and violation of international law are no less important, if arguably less urgent. Namely, Israel's denial of Palestinian refugee rights and its system of racial discrimination against its own Arab Palestinian citizens. Palestinians do not have the luxury to ignore either form of oppression. I'll talk about Israel and the Palestinian refugee rights a little bit. Far from admitting its guilt in creating the world's oldest and largest refugee problem, Israel has constantly evaded any responsibility for the Nakba, or the catastrophe of 1948. Most peculiar in the mainstream Israeli discourse about the birth of the state is the total denial of any crime. Israelis, with a few bright exceptions, regard the ruthless destruction of more than 400 Palestinian villages and their campaign of ethnic cleansing, which led to the exile of more than 750,000 Palestinians around 1948, as Israel's independence. Even committed Israeli leftists, unfortunately, often grieve over the loss of Israel's moral superiority after the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, as if prior to 1967, Israel were as civil and law-abiding as Finland. While denying Palestinian refugees their basic rights, Jewish refugees from World War II in Israel and the West have scored numerous successes in their campaigns for Holocaust restitution and compensation, which often included the right to return to Germany, Poland, and other countries from which they were expelled. Recently, the World Sephardic Federation applied pressure even on Spain to recognize the descendants of the Jews expelled from Andalusia more than 5 centuries ago as Spanish citizens and to rehabilitate them accordingly. The fact that refugees in the Palestinian situation form a majority of the Palestinian people, coupled with their 58-year-old suffering in exile, make the recognition of the basic rights of Palestinian refugees, including the right to return, the litmus test of morality for anyone suggesting a just and enduring solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Moral and legal rights aside, the denial of Palestinian refugee rights guarantees the perpetuation of conflict. Now I'll move to Israel and its own Arab-Palestinian citizens, which Noor Arafat spoke very eloquently about yesterday. Israel might not be unique in racially discriminating against its national minority, but it is certainly unique in its remarkable success so far in getting away with it while projecting a false image of enlightenment and democracy. Yeah, I was told that the F is not understood by those who are not studying sciences. This is a function of ID. Are human rights a function of ID? Sorry. I'm an engineer, so forgive me. At the core of Israel's distinct form of apartheid lies a deep-rooted view of the Palestinian citizens of the state, not just as an undesirable reminder of the original sin, but also as a demographic threat, or what I call relative humans. Racial discrimination against those Palestinian citizens of Israel in every vital aspect of life has always been the norm. In fact, advocating comprehensive and unequivocal equality between Arabs and Jews in Israel has become tantamount to sedition. It's criminal. To this date, significant majorities of Israeli Jews have consistently opposed full equality with the Palestinian citizens of Israel. Israel's laws, including its most fundamental basic laws, have made such discrimination legal, just as in the South African case. This discrimination, however, must be seen in the wider context of Israel's perception of the Palestinians, which is informed by colonial racism and partially by Jewish fundamentalism, which is hardly ever mentioned in the West, unlike Islamic and, to an extent, Christian fundamentalism, which we hear a lot about. I shall not get into this now for the sake of saving time. Israeli politicians, intellectuals, academics, and mass media outlets often passionately debate how best to fight the country's demographic war with the Palestinians. Nobody debates whether there is such a war. Racist walls have been erected not only in the occupied territory, but in several localities inside Israel, which might be news to some of you, where Jews and Palestinians live in close proximity. Many Israelis from across the political spectrum now support various forms of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, even those who are citizens of Israel. This once taboo, extreme right slogan has now become part of the acceptable mainstream discourse about demography in Israel, including in academia, by the way. One conscientious Israeli who is revolted by all this language of demographic control is Dr. Amnon Raz Krakotskin of Ben-Gurion University, who says, quote, "It's frightening when Jews talk about demography," end of quote. What's to be done then? The abject failure of the international community in the last few decades to bring about Israel's compliance with international law has prompted Palestinians to seek alternatives. On July 9, 2005, marking the first anniversary of the ICJ's advisory opinion against the wall, some 170 Palestinian political parties, trade unions, professional associations, and other civil society organizations issued a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, directed against Israel until it fully complies with international law and universal principles of human rights. This BDS campaign is anchored in Palestinian nonviolent resistance to Israeli oppression. Setting an important precedent, this historic call was signed by representatives of the three constituent sectors of the people of Palestine, those under occupation, those in exile, and Palestinian citizens of Israel. During the Oslo period, we got used to defining the Palestinians as those in the West Bank and Gaza only. It's time to correct that. It's also the first time such a nonviolent form of resistance is widely endorsed by virtually all sectors of Palestinian society. A crucial feature in the call, if you might have noticed, is its direct appeal to conscientious Israelis, to support it. There are many arguments against BDS. I shall try to summarize the most rational and popular among them, giving counterarguments, the key to which is the principle of moral consistency. Now, the main arguments against BDS. Some distinguished supporters of the Palestinian cause have argued against applying South Africa-style boycotts and sanctions to Israel for various reasons, most significant of which are: Israel is essentially a democratic country, and therefore it can be convinced to end its oppression without sanctions. Second, unlike in South Africa during apartheid, the majority of Israelis are opposed to sanctions. The third, Israeli civil society organizations are largely progressive and at the vanguard of the peace movement, and therefore they must be supported, not boycotted. Now let's do a reality check. Counterarguments. Democracy. How can an ethno-religious supremacy, that's also a colonial power, ever qualify as a democracy? NYU professor Tony Jude, for instance, calls Israel, quote, a dysfunctional anachronism, categorizing it among the, quote, belligerently intolerant, faith-driven ethnostates. The famous Jewish-American writer I.F. Stone summed up the dilemma of Zionism, saying, quote, Israel is creating a kind of moral schizophrenia in world Jewry. In the outside world, the welfare of Jews depends on the maintenance of secular, non-racial, pluralistic societies. In Israel, Jewry finds itself defending a society in which mixed marriages cannot be legalized, in which non-Jews have a lesser status than Jews, and in which the ideal is racist and exclusivist, end of quote. The second argument, majority. Of all the anti-boycott arguments, this one reflects either surprising naivete or deliberate intellectual dishonesty. Are we to judge whether to apply sanctions on a colonial power based on the opinion of the majority of the oppressor's community? Does the oppressed community count at all? The third one, the pro-peace civil society. This is simply a myth, propagated and maintained by some Israeli academics and intellectuals, including some who define themselves as the left. The vast majority of Israelis serve in the army's reserve forces. Judges, doctors, professors, they all serve in the reserve forces. And therefore, they directly know of and or participate in the daily crimes of occupation and colonization. Moreover, with the exception of a tiny yet crucial minority, Israeli civil society is largely opposed to full equality with the Palestinians and is supportive of the state's oppression or is acquiescently silent about it. A second set of arguments against BDS, the shooting oneself in the foot argument. From a slightly different perspective, some observers have argued that boycotting Israel is counterproductive and may lead to losing the ability to influence Israel's possible path to peace, radicalizing the Israeli right, and pulling the rug from under the feet of the left, indirectly increasing the suffering of Palestinians who stand to lose financially and may even be subjected to deteriorating conditions of oppression by a wilder, more isolated Israel. Second reality check, counterarguments. Influence. What influence? Europe hardly has any right now. Even in the US, the Israelization of US foreign policy, particularly vis-a-vis the Middle East, has reached new depths, effectively tying the hands of any prospective, not that it exists, prospective American pressure aimed at curtailing, not to mention changing, Israel's oppressive policies. Second, marginalizing the left. What left? The Zionist left in Israel easily makes the far-right parties of Europe look as moral as Mother Teresa, especially when it comes to recognizing Palestinian refugee rights. On the other hand, the morally consistent non-Zionist left, the real left in Israel, is a very tiny group whose members may inadvertently end up losing benefits, privileges, and funding as a result of a boycott. This should compel us, however, to nuance our boycott tactics to decrease the possibility of this unnecessarily happening. But we all know boycott is not an exact science, if any science is. We must emphasize the positive impact boycott can have on the overall struggle for human rights, equality, and real democracy, even inside Israel. Contributing to decolonizing Palestine is therefore a morally sound effort that contributes to reconciling the ostensibly conflicting rights of both communities in historic Palestine, the inalienable rights of the indigenous Palestinians to justice, freedom, repatriation, and self-determination, and the acquired rights of Israeli Jews to live in peace and security after they've given up their colonial and oppressive character. I've personally advocated a secular democratic state solution for close to 20 years now. Pragmatic considerations aside, I believe that a unitary state which affords Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews equal rights based on democratic rule and respect for differences and cultural particularity is the only moral and just solution to this conflict. The third argument, indirectly punishing Palestinians, more punishment? It's hard to imagine. Even Archbishop Desmond Tutu was horrified by the elaborate, multi-layered siege Israel has set up in the occupied Palestinian territory, calling for South Africa-style sanctions against Israel. Now we get to a tough argument against BDS, the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. As the French philosopher Etienne Balibar says, quote, Israel should not be allowed to instrumentalize the genocide of European Jews to put itself above the law of nations, end of quote. Beyond that, by turning a blind eye or directly supporting Israel's oppression, as the US and most of official Europe have done, the West has in fact perpetuated the misery, the human suffering, and the injustice that have ensued since the Holocaust. Just the victims have changed. As to the anti-Semitism charge, I believe it's patently misplaced and clearly used as a tool of intellectual terror. It's hardly worth reiterating that Palestinian calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions do not target Jews or even Israelis qua Jews. They're strictly directed against Israel as a colonial power that violates Palestinian rights and international law. The growing support among European and American Jews for effective pressure on Israel is one counterargument that's not well publicized. Regardless, I think it's necessary to reiterate my unequivocal condemnation of all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism and, of course, Zionism. I was asked, what does BDS say about projects that joint projects between Israelis and Palestinians? BDS does not preclude joint Palestinian-Israeli cooperation, so long as it recognizes, as those projects recognize, the reality of oppression, the basic need for equality, and is directed against injustice. It just sets careful criteria for making such projects morally sound and politically effective. It's not enough to call for peace, for this word has become the most abused word in the English dictionary, particularly when two notorious and certified war criminals currently regard themselves as men of peace. Peace without justice is equivalent to institutionalizing injustice. Peace projects which deliberately omit any mention of Israel's, don't laugh, these are my cartoons. And I'm not Danish, so don't worry. Okay, cheap shot, I know. I've written an article on that, but that's for another time. Peace projects which deliberately omit any mention of Israel's oppression of the Palestinians are nothing more than harmful and corrupt endeavors. Those who imagine they can wish away the conflict by suggesting some forums for rapprochement, détente, or dialogue, which they hope can lead somehow to authentic processes of reconciliation and eventually peace, are clinically delusional or dangerously deceptive. Attempting to change the perception of the oppressed rather than help end oppression itself is an indicator of moral blindness and political short-sightedness. Prolonging oppression is not only unethical, it's pragmatically counterproductive as well, for it perpetuates the conflict. Some quick principles of BDS. I don't know what happened with the slideshow. It doesn't matter. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions do not come in one size that fits all. If the basic premise that Israel needs to be pressured in order to comply with international law is accepted, then diverse forms of pressure can be applied in accordance with specific contexts. Whether principled, effective support for this minimal, civil, nonviolent form of resistance to oppression, international civil society organizations will be honoring their moral obligation to stand up for right, for justice, for equality, and for a chance to validate the prevalence of universal ethical principles. They'll also be guaranteeing that no child's knee will shake in fear again, no child's heart will stop beating prematurely, no child's dreams will be extinguished. Thank you. Thank you.